Olá, boa noite. Eu sou Manuel Henrique, estou aqui a representação da Trienal de Lisboa e vou dizer-vos coisas muito práticas para esta última sessão do Human Entities. Obrigado por estarem aqui a resistir. A casa de banho é ali. A saída vai ser por ali, por aquela porta. Se quiserem sair durante a sessão, devem fazê-lo por ali. Esta porta vai estar fechada a partir daqui a pouco. Por isso a única saída é por ali. A porta dá para um espaço que tem uma outra porta que dá para a rua diretamente e está aberta. Portanto, podem sair quando quiserem. Se quiserem fumar, não fumem no vosso lugar. Fumem ali na zona daquele banco. E mantenham a máscara durante a sessão toda. Menos quando estão a beber chá, naturalmente. E pronto, vou passar à Sofia e ao Jared. Okay.
Olá, boa tarde. Obrigado por terem vindo, apesar do frio. Eu espero que esta conversa corra bem. Pronto, confesso que é a primeira vez que estamos a fazer este formato assim misto. Mas pronto, penso que tudo vai correr bem. Só vou mudar para inglês, porque este é um evento internacional também. So, welcome to the last session of the fourth edition of Human Entities. Human Entities is a series of public talks focused on technological change and its impacts, the way culture and technology shape and influence each other. We are CADA, I'm Sofia Oliveira, this is Jared Hockey. And as organizers of this event, CADA must thank the DG Arts for its financial support. CADA would also like to thank our amazing partner, the Lisbon Architecture Triennale, for hosting and promoting the event. And we also are especially grateful to our supporters, the Lisbon City Council, Professor Nuno Correia at Nova Links, Nova University of Lisbon, and Assistant Professor Alexandra Paio from ISCTE EUL. Also like to thank Chloe Gustin, who works with CADA and collaborated in her research for this program. And finally, Julia Steinberger for accepting our invitation.
Now, as countries around the world pin their hopes on technologies solving the problems of climate change, we thought we'd start this session with a list of 20 actions a national government would need to address, and that's fast. These include nuclear, offshore wind, onshore wind, floating wind power, solar, hydrogen, carbon capture and storage, carbon capture and usage, bioenergy with carbon capture and storage, energy storage, meat-eating and food strategy, heat and building strategy, including planning regulations, low-carbon cars, clean aviation, transport infrastructure, CO2 in soil, tree planting, industrial strategy, and new building standards, including home insulation. But the list goes on. Now, obviously, in some areas, recent advances in technology look promising, but in others, less so. And while many of these are decisions that were going to affect us all, when planning this talk today, we couldn't help but feel that we were trespassing. What is the legitimacy of CADA, an art group, to be considering such complex issues? That said, there was one topic we really felt we had to address: carbon emissions from digital technologies, which, by the way, now account for twice as many greenhouse gas emissions as civil aviation. But what is a forum like this for, if it's not a place to grapple with issues of shared concerns, problems which require collective experimentation and cultural shifts? So, how could such a transition to a low-carbon society be achieved in time, that is, within one generation? How realistic is the belief that technology will fix the climate so people don't need to change their behaviour too much? And how are we going to transform entire economies? Would a model of state intervention, a reformist agenda to tilt the playing field, be enough? Or should we be working towards systemic change and radical action to democratise economic power? The reason for inviting Professor Julia Steinberger to speak this evening is to clarify some of these concerns for us. Julia researches and teaches in the interdisciplinary areas of ecological economics and industrial ecology at the University of Lausanne. Previously, she was at the University of Leeds. Her research examines the connections between resource use, that is energy and materials, including greenhouse gas emissions, and societal performance, which covers economic activity and human well-being. She is interested in quantifying the current and historical linkages between resource use and socioeconomic parameters, and identifying alternative development pathways to guide the necessary transition to a low-carbon society. Julia is the recipient of a Leverhulme Research Leadership Award for her research project, Living Well Within Limits, which investigates how universal human well-being might be achieved with planetary boundaries. She is the lead author for the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change's Sixth Assessment Report with Working Group 3. Welcome, Julia.
Hi, everybody. Can you hear me? Thanks so much for having me. I'll start sharing my screen, and I hope that you're all sitting comfortably, if not warmly. I see you have blankets, so that's good. There are a couple of things I wanted to say in terms of your introductory comments, which were very kind. One is that a lead author of the IPCC is actually a reasonably unimportant person. I mean, we might think we're important, but we're like the third tier of importance down. So other people are more important than us for sure. So it sounds very important, but there's actually like hundreds of us. So I just want to place myself in my own, decrease my importance and responsibility in your eyes. And the other thing I wanted to say is that there's a lot of, I'm not an expert in the resource use, energy use, and emissions of digital technologies, but I know that it's an area with a lot of confusion, and people have a tendency of using data that's not coherent or in some cases old. And what I would recommend if you're interested in this, and I'll send it to Sophia, is Carbon Brief have been excellent in this. So they're sort of a group of journalists and researchers on climate, and they've been excellent in trying to understand really coherently what's happening. And so that's just, if you're interested in that specifically, I will send that to you. Okay, so I'm going to be telling you a bit about some thoughts on degrowth and green growth. And I'll try to weave a story and then we'll have a discussion. So I'm really, this is mostly elements for thought, just aspects for reflection. And I think one of the things we're dealing with is we're dealing with two worldviews. And one of the worldviews can be seen as eco-modernism, which really sees green growth as a solution. And this is just one quote from somebody, but I thought it illustrates a bit what that worldview represents, which is that we imagine ourselves being destroyed. We are stuck in a doom story. We need to get out of there. So there's this idea that because we have to face environmental problems, that any talk of degrowth or hurting economic growth is an aspect of doom and very negative. And there's this desire for a positive imaginary that still involves growth, that still involves modernity and technology saving us. So it's really an appeal to the imaginary. And so I think this is really relevant for your art collective, because culture and arts are how we tell ourselves stories and translate them to ourselves as well, and how we translate our imagination. But there's another view of the world, or another view of imagination or desire or wishes, that's degrowth, which corresponds to well-being at low resource use. And this is from Wolfgang Sachs, and it's an incredibly old quote, but he had a lot of good insights. So if the aim of a sustainable economy is to make people satisfied with the least throughput of resources, so throughput being the flow of resources, consumption has to be regarded not as a straightforward benefit, but as a cost of living that should be kept low. And I think that that's really something that I would like you to think about as we go through this together, is what is consumption? Is consumption good or is it a cost of living that we should try to keep minimal? So in terms of the baseline for our debate tonight, I just want to basically go over this because I think sometimes we get into issues. I started out in physics, and the baseline for debate for me is that we have external reality. It exists. At least parts of it can be observed empirically. To understand systemic complicated issues, though, we must build theories. And those theories of systems will, that systemic understanding will shape our actions. So even we have to build theories to understand reality because that reality is systemic and complex, but how we understand the systemic reality will shape how we deal with that reality and how effective we are. And the other thing is reality is more important than feelings and also economics. So this is an image of reality. So we are already in the age of climate change. We are already in this era of the Anthropocene where the climate is different from a climate that we have ever known, not just as people, as it turns out. And I think that Portugal has been having significant climate impacts as well. So this reality can be translated scientifically, for instance, through the perspective of planetary boundaries, where climate is actually only one of them that we're currently coming across and one of the worst in terms of its danger for us. But the reality is that we are facing multiple intertwined environmental crises, which are planetary, accelerating, irreversible. They're linked to the resource use and waste of our society. So through this idea of throughput and flow of our societies, they put the possibility of civilized human societies at risk within this century. And during this decade, they can still be prevented. So depending on what we do right now within these 2020s, we can change the course of events in one direction or the other. I would say that the main ones are climate change, so global warming, which includes ocean acidification. And if you want more information on these, I would, you know, you can consult the IPCC reports or the UNEP emissions gap report. There's also biodiversity and ecosystem loss. So the sixth mass, we're in the midst of the sixth mass extinction, and there are other resources to learn about those. Now, I generally show this figure in my talk because when I'm giving talks to the general public or even students who know more about this, because I think this is really important for us to put ourselves in the understanding of where we are. So global warming means moving the planet into a hotter temperature, but it turns out that hotter temperatures were also in the past of our planet. And so if you can see on this plot, I don't know if you can see, probably can't see my mouse, but it has a lot in it. You may or may not find it artistically pleasing. It has a lot of different colors, but it shows the comet, the current time is the time zero, which is sort of towards the right of the plot. And that's the Holocene. And we are around this little red dot of 2005. That's pretty close to where we are now. And you can see that in the past, which is to the left, there was this flat space, which I've labeled as agriculture and civilization. And that flat space is a flat space in temperature. It's a very narrow range of temperature that we've had in the past 12,000 years. And for our species, that flat space in temperature corresponds to it's known as the Holocene, and it's the time when our species developed everything, developed culture, developed writing, developed cities. So anything that we might call civilization, starting with agriculture as a technology, happened during the last 12,000 years. And the reason for that is because we had just come out of an ice age, and ice ages are really reasonably impossible times. So you can see if you go in the past of the planet, you see these dips below zero temperature, which correspond to the ice ages. And then about 3 million years ago, the temperatures really start ramping up. So the past of the planet was warmer. And so when we go into a warmer future, we can look to the past for how far back we're going. So on our current trajectory, and this is the terrifying thing, we are rolling back the planetary climate clock by 3 million years. And it turns out that that's an age not just before Homo sapiens existed, but before Homo genus existed. So we're talking about a very far time in the past. We'll slow that down so we can get there by 2040, so 20 years from now, if we immediately and massively reduce emissions. So that's sort of what we're looking at. If we keep on our current trajectory, we're talking about rolling back the planetary clock by about 50 million years by 2150. And that's a time so far back that there's nothing, it resembles nothing in terms of our past, in terms of our as a species or as a genus. And there is no way that ecosystems or species can adapt to change that rapid. We're talking about a really cataclysmic event. So what does this mean? And what does this growth, this growth that we're talking about have to do with our future and how we change our trajectory? So I'll talk about some definitions. So the definitions, so just so we're clear on what green growth means, growth is and what we term an exponential growth of economic activity, so gross domestic product. And that's the top curve is what the economy is would be doing. Then the lower curve down would be sort of what our physical resource use corresponds to. And if our resource use is growing, let's say energy or emissions or whatever, is still growing, but growing slower than resource use, that's known as degrowth. If our resource use is growing, is declining, which corresponds to the curve even below that, then our resource, that we know that as absolute decoupling, and that's also green growth. So green growth is kind of a confusing term because it refers both to relative decoupling and absolute decoupling. And for our current time of facing environmental cataclysm on a planetary scale that's extremely rapid and accelerating, we need extremely rapid absolute decoupling. So relative decoupling is not going to be enough. So when people talk about gene growth and relative decoupling, you can immediately say this is not going to cut the mustard. So the kinds of emissions decrease we need are sort of stylized by the IPCC in this plot, where you see that we really need to crash our emissions to zero, sort of really fall off a cliff in order to reach emissions that are consistent with 1.5 degrees or even 2 degrees. We're already crossing tipping points in the Earth system. So one of the things we're seeing is that things that are known as tipping points, so irreversible changes, are already active. So we might not have crossed them yet, but we're already activating them. And so we're really in a situation of extreme danger, and we really need to change fast. Now, what does green growth look like? And this is sort of how I would describe the system of the way people who want the green growth to work see it. So you can start anywhere you want, but let's start with policy nudges, which then inspire innovation, which then make green cheaper, which then lead to more green investment and jobs, which leads to growth prosperity. And so you sort of have this virtuous green growth cycle because growth and prosperity allows the policy nudges to be accentuated. Now, I would say this picture is a bit blind because it omits a lot of different aspects. So the policy nudges are generally explicitly not regulation. You're not talking about forcing industry to act a certain way. You're talking about gently pushing them, guiding them in the right direction. There's a strong belief in technology, which was something that was already raised. We're trying to make green cheaper. And then there's this hope that brown will fade as a result. So we're trying, this avoidance of regulation means that we're trying not to directly target the brown sectors of the economy, which can be an issue. And when we're talking about green investment and jobs, the sort of green growth, we're not taking into account the rebound effect, which is a macroeconomic effect whereby an efficiency in one area leads to growth in the overall system. And so we're sort of expecting the fact that part of the economy is more efficient will not result in more resource use and more pollution through the rebound effect. And we're basically implying that growth is both a cause and result of the greening of the economy, which may or may not be true. And so the question is, what is right about green growth? There's a lot of things that are right about green growth. Unfortunately, I would argue that none of them occur in reality. So my view is extremely strong, and I think the evidence has only grown stronger in recent years. In my view, green growth is an easy to understand fairy tale that will make you have friend in powerful places. So the things that are nice about it, the things that are right about it, have to do with the narrative and have to do with who is comfortable with this narrative, who this narrative is helping. So in the world of ideas, green growth fits perfectly with mainstream economics, so neoclassical economics. There's a supremacy of economic growth is unchallenged, which is our state religion, so that's nice. You don't have to go against the state religion. The market is a place where you make decisions, not a real democracy, not government, not communities. You can leave important decisions to the market. It's consumer and demand oriented. There's a minor role of the state. There's faith in technological innovation, and it ignores completely any issues like ownership and power structures. If you stop ignoring those issues, you do no longer have friends in powerful places. But it must be said that in the world of ideas, economic growth does not have much new. There are huge advantages for green growth. You can use all the existing toolkit of mainstream economics. You don't need to communicate anything new because policymakers are very used to this idea of growth being good. So you just fit right in. You're instantly accepted as serious because you're familiar. It doesn't require massive social or economic change, and it's non-threatening to existing power structures like the owners of major industries. And as a result, you get invited to all the right parties. It connects to sustainable development. If you're interested in sustainable development as a concept, especially the three pillars view of sustainability, which I've shown here, we have social, environmental, and economic pillars. So green growth fits well with these three pillars because you basically see, you translate them into green growth language. So social sustainability is then translated as consumption. You're not touching consumption. That will grow through economic growth. The environment is translated as decoupling, whether relative or absolute, and the economy can keep growing, so it's fine. And this view of sustainability really fits. So basically what you're doing is development continues to be seen as synonymous with economic growth. So you're not challenging anything. So what is wrong about economic growth? I would say a lot more. To start with reality. So here's a question. Can you observe material decoupling? So in the US, you can see the black curve over time, that's GDP going up. And the same in the United Kingdom, GDP is going up. And I'm assuming the same is true in Portugal. I don't have the plot for it, sadly. And you can see a material extraction in the US is actually pretty flat. And you can see material extraction, the blue curve in the United Kingdom is even going down. So wow, this is great. So yes, you can see relative decoupling, at least in the UK, in the US, and you can see absolute decoupling, even if it's not maybe that big in the UK, it's actually reasonably sizable. But what's wrong with this picture? What's missing? And what we're looking at here is we're looking at only the extraction on the territory of industrial countries. What if we could look at all the material use, including the effects of trade, and that we can measure through economic methods. And it looks very different. That's the red curve. So you can see that material decoupling, when countries say, oh, look, we're so great at decoupling, they're generally only looking at the material extraction on their own territory, and they're not looking at material consumption, basically their material footprints internationally. So this is true for the US, it's true for the UK, and it's true for the world. We basically see no decoupling of GDP and our resource use. So there is no decoupling there. So here, I'm just going to try to drive this point home. I'm not gonna read all of this, but there's just more and more evidence coming out, more and more sort of comprehensive reviews that really should demonstrate this point. There is no empirical evidence that absolute decoupling from resource use can be achieved on a global scale if we're growing the economy. So green growth is not possible. And the other point is that absolute decoupling from carbon emissions can't be achieved fast enough. We're facing such a disastrous future if we don't drop our emissions to zero that we don't have time for green growth. Green growth will slow us down. Tim Jackson in Prosperity Without Growth said, green growth requires the invention of a miracle technology. So if we put our faith in green growth, it's like putting our faith in Santa Claus or fairies. it's at the same level of realism. And that's not a safe thing to do if you're a serious person. Jackson and Victor of Green Growth must show that it is possible to effectively eliminate carbon core facts if we're being realistic. Economic growth, the first one is that economic growth is driving environmental breakdown. The cause of our problems is economic growth, both in terms of climate and biodiversity. And there are two papers that came out this year that basically cover the evidence, both for resource use and climate change, which is the scientist warning on affluence. I'm one of the co-authors. And also in terms of the two big challenges of resource use, climate change, and biodiversity, on the other hand, growth is our problem, not our solution. And we can see this in terms of the past evidence. The other point is that proposals that growth can be decoupled from environmental impact do not have a basis in reality. And there are a couple of really comprehensive articles that have come out just recently, again, including systematic reviews. And I just want to give you sort of two quotes from these systematic reviews. And they're all open source. I've put all the citations on this just because I really want to be clear that this evidence exists out there. So one of these says, there is a fundamental incompatibility between economic growth and systemic social changes to address the climate crisis. We need braver conceptual advantages. So this is research telling us we're not doing enough. We're not thinking creatively enough. We're not thinking expansively enough. We really need to to be transformative in how we think and how we think about these problems. And another one from Haberl et al. That says that we need sufficiency-oriented strategies. And this means we need to be questioning consumption. And we need to have strict enforcement of absolute reduction targets. We need to understand the interdependencies between well-being, resources, and emissions. So sufficiency-oriented strategies means that we can no longer have consumption that is expanding. We need to have reductions in physical consumption. And what does that mean for well-being? What does that mean for our economies? And that's one of the things that I research personally. So we'll talk about that a bit more. So green growth, I would say, is a monoculture of ideas. So green growth is preferred by status quo actors in policy, business, academia, and media. And the problem with that is that alternative ideas and theories have been silenced. And if you're working as creative people in technology, I think that one of the things to think about is how to break through that silence, how to come up with a communication that can make it move us away from this monoculture. So critics of green growth are presented as marginal, pessimistic, unrealistic, anti-business, anti-development, anti-social, and informed democratic debate is prevented in this way. So why does this matter? It matters because both ideas and biophysical reality matter. And I would like to present to you another theory of economics, which is actually Marx and political economy. Now, there's an issue because when you say, I'm going to look at Marx and political economy, some people think, oh, you want to go back to Soviet Russia or something. This is not the case. Marx and political economy is an accepted mainstream theory of classical economics. Nobody challenges the fact that this is how capitalism works. Now, what you decide to do about it is a different issue, but the fact that this describes reality is not controversial. So just in case. So in this view of the world, we start with ownership and finance. So that's sort of the main thing you start with. You start with the fact that the economy is an unequal space and certain actors in the economy have a lot more power and influence over what happens through ownership and capital. And they produce and they have a drive to increase efficiency, which because that helps them to be competitive and helps them to make more profit. As a result of that, the price per unit product is always falling. And as a result of that, consumption grows. As a result of that, profit accumulates. As a result of that, the people who are profiting consolidate domination, and the cycle continues. So this is a cycle that looks very different from the other one. And if you know about Marx and political economy, you know that there's an MCM dash. Money goes to commodity, goes to more money. So I sort of tried to indicate where that's happening here. And we're seeing that this theory describes a macro rebound effect where efficiency can be expected and anticipated to drive the expansion of the whole system. We also understand through this vision of the economy that vested interests, so people who are incumbent actors in the economy, already powerful actors, resist decline and change. So you can expect them to be very active in preventing climate action, for instance. Technology serves power and is not neutral. So efficiency will serve those in power and not others. Consumption is induced and demand is engineered. This is known, but not generally put front and center of our economic understanding. Biophysical throughput grows too through consumption. The consumption is not immaterial. Growth in capitalism benefits the wealthy, which is something that Thomas Piketty has shown. Regulation is fought. Subsidies are acquired. Green competitors are kept out. So you can see that this is really a vision of a real economy that where brown incumbents keep the brown aspect of it going. I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but this is sort of a normal way that we can understand capitalism to work. So capitalism has core tendencies and we can understand them systemically in terms of their social consequences and environmental consequences. So things like overproduction, technological dynamism might be of interest to you, so necessary for competitiveness, and it increases labor productivity, but again, it's not neutral. As a result, you have lower prices, higher consumption, and control of labor. Labor productivity increases, higher resource throughput, stocks grow. So you can see that you sort of have these tendencies that are still going, and green growth does not address them at all. And you have overconsumption, you have acceleration, so reduced, and both geographically in terms of space and dynamically in terms of time, these core tendencies change the way that we're interacting with our environment. And that is, I would argue, the reality of the world that we're in. Now, this is, I hope you enjoy this. This is as artistic as my contributions get. So this is, again, to contrast these two visions. In the neoclassical version of the green economy, there's this idea that the economy is a horizontal market. And you can sort of see it as the flat surface of the sea, which is this sort of green puddle here. And producers are sort of equally small. None of the producers, they're the ants with the buckets. They're pouring things into the market, their production. And they're not, none of them is big enough to dominate. They're all sort of equally small. And so nobody has an influence like a cartel or a monopoly. And the consumers are also equally small. Nobody is influencing things too much. And consumers have preferences and they each have their own favorite kind of beer and everybody is happy. And so this is this sort of idea of the market being this place of equilibrium where producers and consumers meet in perfect harmony and everybody ends up smiling and happy at the end of the day. And I would argue that there's another cartoon version of the economy, which is very different, which has to do with these clusters of supply chains, of vertical supply chains, that are connected to each other and really strongly connected to each other through technology clusters. And here you can see the producers are the big profiters, are the big owners, Mr. Monopoly. In this case, I've shown a cluster which has to do with car dependency. So you have petroleum, petrol, diesel, road infrastructure, private cars, and suburban real estate, so urban planning that encourages car use. And they sort of create the market. And the market is not this place of free choice. This market is much more like a funnel where the consumers don't have a choice and they all end up driving cars. The car is the answer to everything. And the role of the government is really this scaffolding or this infrastructure that supports these interconnected technology clusters through subsidies, through regulation in lots of different ways. And we can study how that, we have studied how, for instance, this happens over time. So how and why does our understanding of the economy matter? Which version of reality matches our observation best? I would say that the persistent economic coupling with resource use and pollution matches the Marxian political economy best. Fossil fuel industries, in fact, are extractive of our economies at the point of extraction. They extract surplus labor as normal in the economy. They induce consumption and extract from there. And they also extract from our government. So they extract from private, from our paycheck every month, they take something. And from the government, they also capture public subsidies. The macroeconomic rebound effect is observed and modeled as a key driver of economic growth. So that is very well observed as well. And growth, as expected, does not decouple from environmental impacts and resource use. And I just wanted to give you a bit of an example of state capture in action. So Kate Bayless and Giulio Mattioli are colleagues of mine. They wrote, as part of my project, Living Well Within Limits, they wrote a report to the UN Rapporteur on Extreme Poverty, who was visiting the United Kingdom at the time. And they wrote about privatization in bus, water, and electricity. And the UN Rapporteur, this is from his report, he took that into account, and he said, if you just look at the last sentence, abandoning people to the private market in relation to the services that affect their well-being without guaranteeing access to minimum standards is incompatible with human rights. So a very strong statement against privatization and against profiting from people, no matter what the circumstance. And our government hated that report so much that Amber Rudd, who was the Minister of the Interior at the time, lodged a complaint at the UN accusing the report of being biased. So my research apparently, and my research of my colleagues, is biased because we point out these problems with our current economic system. So back onto the last part, how does our understanding guide our actions? I think one of the things we really need to do is to integrate social and environmental focus. So this is Kate Raworth and her book, The Donut Economics, which it has been translated into Portuguese. So I was happy to find a copy of the book there, and I really recommend it, particularly because she's interested in design. She's interested in visual representations of alternatives. So if you do nothing else as a result of this evening, go look for Kate. She's got YouTube videos. She's got a TED Talk. She's got all kinds of websites and active initiatives. And her book is fantastic. So I really recommend it. And she's come up with this idea of the safe and just space for humanity, which is where we manage to deal both with social deprivation, which is the empty middle of the donut, and with planetary boundaries, which is when we fall outside the boundaries of what the planet can deal with. And so we really need to have an integrated social and environmental focus. And I think that's really the way forward. We actually tested countries to see if we could measure whether countries were within or without the donut. So this is a result from our paper in 2018. I'm afraid that Portugal doesn't do very well. Portugal transgresses all the planetary boundaries we could measure and doesn't achieve all of the social thresholds. Those are the little red ones in the middle. And for instance, Sri Lanka, which is the other country, doesn't do so well on social thresholds, but also doesn't transgress planetary boundaries. And so that's sort of an example of what happens. I'm just going to skip over some of this. Is it possible to live well with lower consumption? And if yes, can we design eco-social policies, so integrated policies and politics, to have safe and prosperous economies? And I think that that's really our challenge. What we did is we used ideas around Kate Raworth's donut to imagine and model a different future. So we used the living, the Professor Narasimha Rao of Yale University has developed this theory of decent living energy. And his theory links human needs satisfaction and minimum levels of energy services. And our global models takes this into account, and it takes into account technological improvements. So improvements that allow people to use less and get more, equal human need satisfaction. So everybody gets enough, but nobody gets too much or too little, and degrowth in terms of resource use. And our model looks like this. I'm sorry if the picture is not very beautiful, but we take into account these decent living standards, and then we sort of blow them up in terms of their resource use. So food, cooking, thermal comfort, in terms of public consumption in schools and hospitals, in terms of business, in terms of general infrastructure. And so I don't want to get into too much detail, but this is just to give you a sense of what sufficient energy for all would look like. So we have a certain amount of nutrition, a certain amount of living space. It's always going to be at 20 degrees, much warmer than you're now. Sorry about that. Clean water, communication, et cetera, and all the embodied energy required for the appliances and infrastructure and so on, including for internet and data and mobility and so on, and health and education. So just to show you some results, the reference model of where we're headed on this business as usual trajectory is the red line. It continues our current growth. And in our model, we would actually achieve sufficient energy for all where that green arrow is in 2050. And so sufficient energy for human need satisfaction all over the world would be possible at 40% of our current consumption despite population growth. And I think that that's really something to think about in terms of joining up equity, very high high-tech sufficiency in order to change the world to a more sustainable trajectory. So we need eco-social research, policy, politics, culture, communication. I really like this paper by Tuli Hirvilämi and Tuna Helne on changing paradigms. So what is sustainable well-being and eco-social policy? There's these ideas of Green New Deal goals. And now that Biden is president, it's not going to be perfect, but his current climate plans look a lot more like this than they did Obama's climate plans, for instance. And if you're interested in degrowth, there's actually an explosion of growth in degrowth books. So I really recommend that you look into these books. I'm happy to share the references also with Sophia and with your group. So this is a fantastic time to be learning about this. And there's a lot of creativity and imagination going into it. So I really recommend looking at some of these references. And so what should we do about it? Because I've also had to think about how I manage this in my professional life. I believe that scientists, so as an academic, I have a duty to act on the knowledge that myself and my colleagues are putting out there. So I believe that we have a moral duty to join the popular movements demanding political action. And I'm part of scientists who endorse calls for civil disobedience, and to really force climate action. And I'm part of Extinction Rebellion, even though I'm sometimes critical of them as well, but I am part of them. So I do believe that we have these duties to tell the truth, to act now, and to beyond politics for me is really this call for democratizing our economies, bringing our economies and everything in our societies into the realm of democratic discourse and debate. And one of the things that's been incredible within Extinction Rebellion is seeing the role of culture and arts in bringing these ideas forward, I was actually part of a Leeds, of the climate change citizens jury in Leeds. It was fantastic. So I really encourage these initiatives. I don't know if something similar is happening in Portugal or not. And they had really fantastic recommendations that go far beyond, much more in the direction of degrowth than in the direction of green growth, I would say. So I would say that green growth, that degrowth is also something that has popular appeal and democratic appeal. And that's where I wanted to end it. So thank you very much.
Hi, no, I acho que can you hear me? No? Yes? Okay, so first of all, thank you so much. It was really, really interesting. And like the goals, it makes total sense, but how do we go about it? Like what are the, you know, the first measures or how do we nudge in the easy fairy tale and realistic version of the green growth? We could understand how to go about it. It all started with political nudges, but how do we go about fixing the problem in a more realistic way, in your view? Thank you.
That's a difficult issue, but I think that it has to. I think that the solution really has to be to be developing integrated social and environmental policy. So we can no longer be separating environmental policy from economic policy, from social policy. So we have to have our welfare and our economy integrated in something that's environmentally sustainable. And I think that the most promising direction here, I'm really convinced of this, that some of the best eco-social packet frameworks are around the Green New Deal. So the Green New Deal really does do this thing where you start from an environmental perspective and then you build the economy that allows that to happen. And I think that one of the most important things that we can all do is we need to stop to de-license or to stop bad actors in the economy. And so these are fossil fuel companies, automotive industries. So they're really strong, powerful conglomerates within our economies that we need to fight. This is not going to be a tea party or pleasant. It's going to be a struggle. And so I think that that's something that we have to be to prepare for. And the way to do that is to have popular policies on the one hand. So the Green New Deal policies are very popular wherever they've been developed, and they really carry the ambition forward. And on the other hand, we have to be willing to take away the social license from these large industries and really expose them for what they are. And I think that there's a huge role of communication here. The fossil fuel industries, including Exxon, Shell, BP, and including the automotive industries as well, have known that they were pushing us into climate change for as long as I've been alive, for more than 40 years. So we need to take these bad actors out of our economy. We need to delegitimize them. And I think that that's something that it's a political struggle. It's not, you know, turning a light switch off. That's what they want. That's what they want us to believe, by the way. It turns out that BP, British Petroleum, was the company that developed carbon footprinting to make people feel guilty individually. They want us to feel individually guilty while they commit crimes against humanity. I mean, this is completely unacceptable. So we really need to see our role much more as actors in a struggle, and much less as individuals. We need to be working on this together. And I think that Green New Deal idea is sort of pushing those forward as a positive vision, and at the same time denouncing the negative actors who are the ones benefiting from growth. By the way, growth is very unequally distributed. They benefit, we don't. So that's something else to highlight. So I think there's two aspects to it.
So hi, Julia. Thank you for that amazing talk. It's a little bit in the sequence of the previous question, where you said that green growth was mainly adopted through nudging, so policy nudging, rather than policy regulation. Therefore, is degrowth only possible through policy regulation? And is it top-down or bottom-up policy, would you say? Sorry, I keep looking there. I should be looking here.
So thanks for your question. And I think degrowth is something that has a lot of different scales and different scales of action. So ultimately, one of the things we need is we need regulation that says, for instance, we're not allowed to have emissions anymore. You know, that's something that regulation can do. But degrowth is also very much about popular movement. So it's a very social perspective, a very bottom-up and very democratic perspective. And it's really a lot of what degrowth researchers study, like in the Degrowth in Movements book, for instance, is they study these popular movements that have allowed alternative economies to flourish. So it's about building alternative economies. And that's something that we can do. We can learn to take control over our economies again. But that happens very locally usually. So it happens at the neighborhood scale or at the city scale or at the regional scale that we build these alternative structures. But it's definitely about that work of building alternative societies that allow us to live at lower resource use and that allow us to not depend on economic growth. So that's one of the things that we really need to do to make our societies safe is we have to remove that dependence from economic growth and build that. So it's there's a lot of bottom-up work to do, and eventually one can take over in terms of national policy as well, because that's certainly necessary. So I think there's both directions, there's a core role for activism. So we're not talking about consumers anymore. Nobody gets to see themselves as a consumer. That's the last thing in the world that we should ever see ourselves as. We should see ourselves as actors, as agents of change, as agents of care for each other. But we should not be seeing ourselves as consumers. That's the wrong perspective. We shouldn't feel too guilty about our consumption because we have to consume things to stay alive. So that's another perspective. You can spend a lot of time agonizing over consumption. But we need to really create this new world together, and that involves work.
Thank you.
Hi. first of all, thank you for being so straight to the point. More than informative, I think it's truly inspirational, your sharing and your research. But my question for you is about European Union. Two levels or two different questions within the same one. The first, usually the European Union tends to be criticized about being too regulation-driven. But despite the fact that you just have shared about bottom-up pressure that could lead to a new type of regulation, I'd like to listen your consideration on this. I mean, in the end of the day, is the European Union right about reinforcing the need of regulation? And the second one is, we have been listening a lot, and we'll keep for sure for the next years, about the European Union Green Deal and all the huge amount of money that's going to be poured in this, let's say, platform or project. And I'd like to listen and get to know your considerations about the current plans or what you know about it so far. If you could understand some positive or negative sides on this when you face your approach versus the Green Deal. Thank you.
So I'd just like to let you know that my partner is putting my son to bed next door and things are apparently not going well. So if that's what you hear, that's what's going on. Sorry about that. I'll try not to go and intervene. So in terms of your question, in terms of the regulation, so I think the European Union sometimes actually is quite weak. I know there's the reputation of regulation, but in terms of what it can actually do, it's quite weak compared to the national governments. The national governments are still ruling very much what's possible. And I think regulation has, in some cases, a bad reputation. I think if you look at what, for instance, Trump was doing as soon as COVID hit, he removed all the regulations that, I don't know if you got this news, but I don't think it was reported as widely as he should. He removed all the regulations on all fossil fuel industries. He was like, oh, we need to have relief for the economy. You know, so they started doing things like just like dumping waste and not even flaring gas, just like pushing it out without even burning it from their refineries. I mean, so the health of the people who live near refineries got even worse in terms of respiratory disease, which means that they died even more of COVID because of that lack of regulation. So I think that we also need to learn to see regulation as something that's protective. Although, of course, that doesn't mean we shouldn't criticize it. I'm very critical of European regulation, for instance, on biofuels, which is an environmental disaster. So if you know about palm oil production, it's driving deforestation in Indonesia, causing mass extinction, for instance, of orangutans. So just like massive environmental devastation. A lot of that palm oil, about half of it, goes into biodiesel. So that's your sustainable solution. You know, and that was the green growth hope of the European Union. So, of course, I'm going to be critical of that regulation that causes so much devastation. But I think the European Union is a democratic structure. And it's very interesting because you can intervene with your MEPs. Each of you has several MEPs, probably three, four, I don't know, from where region you live in, you have several of them. And you will have some that are on the left and some that are on the right and some that are on the extreme right. And I can guarantee that you personally have MEPs that have been corrupted or that are in the pocket of the fossil fuel industry. And that are doing, because those lobbies are present in Brussels and extremely effective, and that you personally can intervene to shine a light on what your MEPs are doing, saying, and stop that corruption. Because as soon as somebody looks at them, they get quite embarrassed and it shines a light on it. So that's something that the European Union is, in the end, these people, and these people have certain roles to play. So I think having a look at what's happening and shining a light on it, I think is very interesting. And if you want, I have specific examples of that. In terms of the Green New Deal, obviously it's a nice idea. It started out nicer than the implementation, but again, that's something that we can move. And so the fact that there are activist movements in Europe, that there's Fridays for Future, that Europe also has its own think tanks, right? So there's places like the Zoe Institute, which are very important in terms of having a real alternative economic vision of what that should be, means that we can keep the ambition, we can try that to always focus the ambition on what the Green New Deal should be as opposed to what it is right now. So right now, there are a lot of aspects that are extremely disappointing in it, but at least it's there. And at least it's something that can be improved. So it's not because it's not perfect that we give up and go home. Because it's there, because there's that stated desire, we can really pressure the European Union to do a lot better. And that's our job. Honestly, that's what we really need to be doing. And you can see what constant positive pressure from activist movements can do, for instance, in the US. I mean, Joe Biden started out with a climate plan that was extraordinarily disappointing. And because young activists kept pushing him all the time and never gave up and also voted for him, like they got lots of young people to vote in unprecedented numbers. So they did both. They supported and pushed. That now he has one of the best climate, you know, something that nobody would have dreamed could be possible. And that's much closer to a Green New Deal than it was. So I think we keep pushing. And there are structures and ways to get engaged that can help with that pushing, like the Zoe Institute and like pushing with your own MEPs. I would really encourage that. There are people.
Just to make sure, Zoe, Z-O-E. Fiku, just to make sure, Zoe, Z-O-E.
Z-O-E, yeah, Zoe Institute. They're great. And they've been putting out a lot of really good stuff. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Julia, do you mind stop sharing your screen so we could see bigger? Thank you.
Yeah. And now on the big head, right? Sorry.
One more question.
Okay.
What about nuclear?
I'm sorry?
What about nuclear power? Do we keep existing stations open?
Yeah. That's a huge issue. That's a huge issue. For instance, in Switzerland, we have these super old power stations, apparently the oldest ones in Europe. And what do you do about it? So nuclear power is quite an interesting case because it represents centralized technology, which is something that a certain type of policymakers and governments really like and contractors really like. At the same time, it's extremely expensive. So it's actually not necessarily economically competitive these days. Per kilowatt hour, especially not if you would take into account risks and cleanups, which are generally de-risked and taken out of the equation by governments. So lots of people have different opinions on it. My opinion on it is that our current infrastructure of nuclear energy, we sort of have a duty to keep going as long as we can and as long as it's safe, because it's low carbon and it's there. So we might as well use it. But I don't think that we should be building more because other technologies are actually cheaper, in some ways more resilient. Nuclear also has climate risks associated with it because it requires cold water. And so, for instance, I live in Geneva, on the Lake Geneva, and the Rhone, as it goes through France, cools a lot of the nuclear power plants. But because we have climate change, the Rhone's already getting warmer. So you have issues around the cooling water available to nuclear power plants around the world. And that's an issue. So you have this, it's not necessarily robust to climate change as much as we might want it to be. So I think that my view is that we need to keep nuclear power going. And we need to be working on replacing that capacity with other technologies as fast as possible. And I think that all of this will be a lot easier in a lower consumption world. So if we can actually reduce our energy demand, including of electricity, by using efficient demand-side technologies and demand-side infrastructures. So if we focus on reducing demand, and that's another investment. I mean, this is actually, if you think about it from a Keynesian perspective, you're still investing stuff into the economy. You're still creating lots of good jobs. I'm sorry. But we need to view demand side as an equal investment to production, or even a more important investment to production. So investment in allowing people not to have high demand. And when you were listing your technologies at the beginning, I thought it was quite interesting. You were listing a lot of production side technologies and some demand side ones, but maybe not as much. And I would, and this is a known fact that demand side investment is a complete afterthought in climate and energy policy, which is completely criminal. And it's because it's decentralized. It's because central corporations don't necessarily, you know, there's not the megacorp of building retrofit. Because it's, you know, it's going to be little companies dotted around the country, dotted around the city doing it. Well, that's good for the economy. It's good for jobs. It's good for income distribution. But it's not good for centralized profits. And I think that we really need to force the issue that demand reduction and investment in demand reduction, in making demand reduction possible, has to be equal to production side investment. So that's my view. So it's a bit of both end. I think we need to keep nuclear power going. I'm certainly not in favor of shutting down everything right now, but I don't think that investing in lots of new nuclear capacity is economically sensible or necessary.
Thanks.
So, I mean, per kilowatt hour, it's a lot more expensive than solar wind right now. So why not invest in those?
Sure. I've got another one then.
Okay.
So. I mean, it's in terms of individual responsibility. I mean, do you see any role for or any hope in a government, for example, rolling out like a track and trace system for smartphones and people's to measure people's carbon footprints, or alternatively, some sort of system where you're given kind of carbon credit and you pay for goods with carbon credit and money, and that carbon credit system would be equal for each rich people and poor people alike. I mean,
I'm not against that in any way. But one of the things I think is that it's simply not logistically possible or physically possible for an average person to individually reduce their emissions in the way we need to do in the next 10, 20 years, right? It's just not, you know, even if the government did that and rolled out these kinds of measures, we couldn't do it on our own. It's not up to us. Nobody right now in our societies can live a zero carbon life, because that ability, that infrastructure that would allow us to do that is non-existent. Or very little of it is in existence yet. So we do need massive public investment to allow us to live in buildings that are zero carbon, to allow us to have access to appliances that are zero carbon, to make cheap plant-based diets. You know, a lot of stuff is cheap already in that sense. Lentils are cheap, but to sort of roll it out in a way that everybody has access to it. So. And for instance, transportation is a huge one, because a lot of people simply don't have access to a place where it's safe to get on a bicycle or to a place where public transportation is available. So a lot of people don't have a choice. If they leave their house, they're like, oh, well, I'm really scared because there are a lot of cars out there. I can't get on a bike and there's no bus. So what am I going to do? Stay at home? Well, obviously everybody's staying at home right now. But in general, transportation is a huge one where investment is needed. So I don't think that it's something where the government or whatever can impose this on people individually without providing the facility for low carbon life. So, and I think the priority has to be providing the facility for low carbon life. And I would argue that a lot of that is on the demand side rather than on the supply side. And the other point I would make is, that there has to be an equalizing aspect of it. And that one of the reasons there has to be an equalizing aspect of it is because poor people cannot afford a low carbon life. Like normal people cannot afford it. You can't, you know, it's not somebody who's renting an apartment who can afford thousands and thousands of euros of investment into efficient technologies. It's too much. And even for the owners of the buildings. So we're talking about a huge industrial transformation of our economies, mainly on the demand side, I would argue. And then ramping up renewable energy a bit, and we're good, we're done. So that's the thing. So I think that individually, there's We can do a lot. We can do a lot. But the main thing we can do is become activists, learn to pick up the phone, learn to insist on having meetings with our politicians, and become sort of braver advocates. You'd be amazed at how much difference one meeting with a politician does. I mean, I've done it myself. I've gone to visit my MP in the UK, and he went from somebody who had never really talked about climate change and voted for the Heathrow expansion to somebody who published articles saying we need to step up on it. You know, I wasn't the only one, but like, it really matters. Getting out there and becoming advocates is far more than individual action. So I really recommend that we all do that, because I don't see any other way around.
Thanks. Any more? So I've got time for one more. Can I just do one more? We're all a bit cold here, but...
Yeah, I feel so bad. I've got tea.
Okay. Yeah, it's... okay, it was beautifully clear, but for somebody who doesn't understand economics, somebody who's coming from this from the outside, why not just change GDP? I mean, why don't we just factor in energy, for example, into the equation? Why don't we, you know, so
have a different indicator as a goal?
Yeah, well, you know, we're measuring labor and capital, machinery, so why don't we just see where energy fits in relation to labor and machinery, for example?
But having a better measurement or accounting of that wouldn't change the system.
Yeah, but then you could say what we're using more, you could kind of quantify what we're using better. So therefore, there might be some sort of model between green growth and degrowth,
we can measure energy perfectly well. I mean, I don't know how this helps with communication, because we can measure energy perfectly well. We have pretty good accounting systems for that. So I don't see how that changes.
There's no advantage there. Okay.
I'm sorry?
So there's no advantage in changing that model. I'm just trying to think of a way that it might sit better with, you know, the status quo at the moment, because I suppose underlying my question is a doubt about the speed or the time that we've got to kind of convert conservative minds.
Yeah. Well, I think that coming up with popular plans is popular sort of justice and equality and welfare-based plans like the Green New Deal. I mean, the Green New Deal, I should have talked about it more, but there's the basic idea that we need to get our emissions to zero and do all the things necessary for that. There's the idea that we're going to give people jobs doing that. Everybody gets a job, everybody gets training. There's the idea that there's the strengthening of the welfare state to do that, because we're talking about transforming the economy really fast. So that's upsetting, different. During a time of great change, we need to protect each other. And the way we do that is through this expanded welfare state that's really strengthened, where you don't have any of the privatization that's happening in the UK, for instance. And the fourth element is you pay special attention to the frontline communities, who are people either impacted by pollution, impacted by climate change impacts, or impacted by industrial transformation. So who are, for instance, right now working in oil sector, automotive sector, and will have to change their jobs. So that gives you a sort of comprehensive positive vision. And that's very effective in transforming where people are going. So that has transformed the conversation completely in the UK, in the US, with Biden, for instance, who now has a very strong climate plan because of that positive vision. And the Republicans, I mean, I don't know if you saw that, but I think it was yesterday or before yesterday, Ivanka Trump was like, but we actually reduced carbon emissions by 8% this year, right. Which is fantastic. All of a sudden they care. But but you really are able to move the dip. I mean, of course, they're taking credit for COVID and an economic crisis, that they're terrible people. But you're able to really shift the debate. So when you're talking about appealing to conservative people or appealing to people who might not have a vision of climate action being positive for the economy, I think that presenting this as an investment that has lots of employment, that is compatible with strengthened welfare and strengthened prosperity, that positive vision, you know, and where you're paying really close attention to the people most affected as these frontline communities, I think that that's a really positive package to bring forward. And then you don't care if you grow or not. You don't have to bring growth into it. The Green New Deal was very clever. It never mentioned growth.
Yeah. Okay.
So don't forget about growth. Don't talk about it.
Yeah.
Just focus on the positives.
Okay.
And the positive is investments, it's jobs, it's welfare. Exactly. We can do it.
Okay, great. Thanks. I've just got, this is really the last question, unless anybody else has got one. Everybody's freezing.
I'm so sorry.
Do you think, though, I don't know whether you'd agree with this, but since January this year, I've seen in the news, in the mainstream news, lot more talk about, not degrowth, but so much, do we need economic growth? Questions like that have been popping up. Have you felt that, or are you feeling that there's also a kind of,
Because one of the things that COVID, I actually wrote something on this, but and many people have written on it, but the COVID crisis has shown us that our economies don't protect us. So our economies right now are very structurally dependent on growth, which is unsafe, because it means as soon as you start degrowing the economy, you start a crisis and people lose their jobs, people lose their houses, people lose their businesses. It's just a complete disaster, right? And that meant that our governments were often torn. They were like, oh, well, we have to protect the economy, but that means killing people because we're going to keep businesses and restaurants and whatever open and force people back to work if we keep the economy running and people will die. Or we protect people by sort of hitting pause on the economy, but then we have a crisis and evictions happen and people lose their jobs and people go hungry. So there were really this huge conflict. And I think people that really made people realize that growth dependency is dangerous. Like if all your economy can do is grow, it is not going to protect you in the century that is coming our way, in the years that are coming our way, because this pandemic was not a surprise. It was a surprise to us. It was not a surprise to anybody who studies public health or disaster risk. So we are coming into a century of disasters.
Right.
And our growing, having growth dependent economies is dangerous. It's dangerous for public health, quite simply. So that's one thing that people are starting to question more. And the thing that's very interesting is that there's this example of the well-being economies. Again, they don't talk about growth. They just talk about well-being. So it's the Well-Being Economic Alliance, and I would encourage you to try to get Portugal to be part of it. And they include New Zealand, Costa Rica, Iceland, Scotland, I think are some of the countries that are in it. And in general, they had much better responses to the COVID crisis because they'd already been thinking about how to organize their economies and their policies in a way that prioritizes well-being and doesn't care so much about growth. So they'd already started to take this turn away from growth dependency, and they've actually done better economically, even just in terms of growth, because they've managed to protect their economies against this kind of crisis. So having this perspective that human health, well-being, and environmental sustainability come first, and the economy serves those, whether it's growing or not, that helps. That's something that is really a protective element. So I really encourage you to also look at this Well-Being Economics Alliance. I think they're doing fantastic work and really encouraging governments to have very positive policies, making a real difference in people's lives. So it's good.
Great. Okay. Well, thank you so much. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you, everybody. Yeah. Go warm up. And one day I look forward to being in Lisbon again when we're able to leave our houses. So maybe I'll see some of you then. Thank you so much.